So all of the film and TV has just been shredded and then just sort of arranged in a pick and mix. It's just been laid out for people to consume in 90-second bits.
It's like somebody cutting up your food for you.
it's sort of been pulverized, and you know, you're now drinking, you're drinking your culture through a straw.
Welcome to Cooper and Carey Have Words. My name is James Carey. I live here in Ingerland in the southwest. Over there in Florida is my good friend Barry Cooper. Hello, Barry, in Florida land. How are you?
James Carey, I'm doing all right. Lovely to hear your voice and lovely to see the perfectly formed but small face of our mutual friend, Nate Morgan Locke. We've invited him on the show for very good reasons. James, what are those reasons?
Hello, Nate, first of all.
Hi. Hi.
Hello, sir.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Hello.
It felt like Nate might have some things germane to our discussion, because today we are talking about, let's call it, addiction to distraction, or distracted to the point of addiction. The reason for this is there was a Substack post called The State of the Culture 2024 by Honest Broker is the name of the Substack. The writer has a slightly hard to pronounce name. We're going to call him Ted
G-I-O-I-A.
Goya?
Goya.
Let's call him Ted
Goya. He's an
Goya.
American jazz critic, isn't he? A music historian.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't quite know. He wrote a very interesting piece, and he wrote A State of the Culture in 2023 as well, which is also quite good. But it felt like this one kind of did the rounds, and some of our Patreons shared it as well. And if I may just briefly summarize it, he makes the point, and I do recommend you follow a link in the show notes and read it for yourself. It won't take you terribly long. But he points out, he starts by saying that culture used to be like politics, where you get two choices. Well, in the UK, you got three, but effectively it was two. Art and entertainment. And then he's got a lovely graphic of art being eaten by entertainment, sort of two fish. The big entertainment whale is consuming art. But then he kind of points out to the fact that we're witnessing something in a post-entertainment culture, that we're being distracted, that actually entertainment, which was previously the bad guy, as opposed to art, is now being, we're now distracting ourselves to death. And that this in itself is not the biggest problem. The biggest problem is the fact that Silicon Valley views culture not just as distraction eating entertainment, which is eating art, but addiction is even bigger than all of them. And they're basically trying to get us hooked on their platforms. And therefore, this powerful graphic came about called The Rise of Dopamine Culture. And so in a slow culture, athletics is playing a sport. Fast modern culture, athletics is watching a sport. But dopamine culture is gambling on a sport. Journalism used to be newspapers, then it was multimedia, and now it's clickbait. Video was film and television, then fast modern culture made it sort of YouTube video, and now it's reels of short videos and TikToks and so on. Relationships, courtship and marriage became sexual freedom, which is now swiping on an app. So anyway, I'm sure that you other guys have got comments to make about this, but I thought that was a really interesting sort of starter for 10 in terms of a discussion about where our society is going, our culture of distraction. And he is arguing that this isn't just distraction, this is weaponized to the point of trying to create addiction. Have I summarized that article? Anyone want to lob in any clarifications? There are lots of good graphics to go with it if you do go and chase it down.
Yeah, it's very good. And I think there's lots that's positive and helpful, I think, about these insights. There's always, we can always quibble about, well, is it very reductive to create these little graphs? Everything's kind of can sometimes get squeezed through this hermeneutical grid, which you've already decided to impose on it. So is that distorting the data, or actually is it an accurate reflection of it? I think we can, you know, make all those sorts of comments, and we probably will a bit later. But I think it is quite helpful to see how there has been this progression towards more atomized, decontextualized information that's coming at you fast. And I think there is a profound effect on people. Part of the question is, what is people, though? And I think his definition of what people are, that they're almost sort of just dopamine-seeking machines, is where the Christian perspective on it is more interesting and something we'll get into. But Nate, what do you think there was anything in there that was, okay, yeah, that has explanatory power, that was useful, I appreciated his take on this particular thing?
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting. In fact, when you sent me the link and said, this is what we're going to be chatting about on the show, I thought, oh, did I send you that link or did you send me that link when the article first came out? Because I remember reading it, but my takeaway from it, if someone had said, oh, what's that article about? I would have just used the phrase post-entertainment. Now, I know you guys want to talk a bit more about the dopamine stuff later on and exactly how our brains are rewired and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I think for me, the idea that, that initial thing of art swallowed by entertainment, swallowed by distraction, that for me was the most interesting thing because it correlated with all the stuff I've been thinking about and blabbering on about the attention economy on various different platforms and places for the last
that
maybe
was really
year
talk
now.
A little bit about attention economy Nate, because I've heard you speaking about that on other podcasts. It's really helpful stuff.
So
what do you mean by that?
Friends, Romans, countrymen, sell me your ears. That's really how I usually introduce it. Basically, your eyeballs, your eardrums are for sale. And the way people are going to make money is by getting your attention and then keeping your attention for as long as possible. So arguably, there's nothing especially new about it. It's just that it's been taken to a kind of nuclear level with the advent of the smartphone and then the sort of ubiquity of the smartphone and the fact that everything is done on the same device now means that the ability of various platforms to keep your attention for longer has just grown massively, particularly with the sort of sharpening of the blade with the kind of TikTok vertical video approach. So all the platforms now, whether it's Twitter or YouTube or Facebook or whatever, they all had to respond to the advent of TikTok by having their own vertical video scrolling feature, which they're all trying to push because they know that this is the most addicting, as the Americans would say, or addictive, as we would say here in sunny old England, way of getting and keeping people's attention.
On the tee, it's Mr. Barry Cooper and Mr. James Carey. They 4,000 miles apart, but they never alone. They two middle-aged chimps with a microphone. Walking around in the easy fit jeans, cause they won an award in 2018. Stuffing their face with a bag of crispy Funyuns. They never missed a chance to diss John Bunyan.
Let's push back briefly, though. I listened to a podcast this morning, a friend of the show, Thomas Umstead Jr., a man who can talk and smile at the same time, I often say. He was doing a podcast about AI, but he started with Socrates and how Socrates was despairing of what would happen if people started writing things down. There goes your ability to remember epic poetry. It's the beginning of the end. And so, you know, when Socrates is moaning about the attention economy and newfangled devices, there's that. And, you know, and every, you know, X hundred years, there is a new revolution in information. So one is, was it ever thus? And then secondly, which maybe we could come back to, we do still live to some extent in a boxed set era. And we do have a capacity to watch many episodes of one thing. And so you know, the obvious, I don't know, if, what since Breaking Bad, what's been the thing? But somebody might say, you should watch Breaking Bad. That is 80 hours of television right there. And people are kind of looking for their next thing. And so I would possibly argue when it comes to the right thing, people are prepared to surrender to it, to submit to it and enjoy it and savor it. And maybe not second screen.
I would say, okay, granddad. everyone is second screening whilst watching Breaking Bad. Like if you, like people's capacity to literally just watch one screen in front of them is disappearing. And I think that's what he's on about in the article. I think that this post-entertainment thing is that the film and television companies, I mean, sort of discusses the way in which, you know, the industry, the film industry has been ruined by streaming and the TV industry is kind of doesn't know what to do. And because all everyone wants to do is just infinitely scroll through their phone, looking at, as Barry said, atomized, decontextualized clips of those shows. And the shows that are most sprinkled, dumped into the algorithm, are the ones that lend themselves most to a decontextualized joke. So The Office, particularly American version, obviously, but Family Guy, all of that sort of stuff. So all of the film and TV has just been shredded and then just sort of arranged in a pick and mix, arranged. It's just been laid out for people to what consume in 90-second bits. I think
it's like somebody cutting up your food for you.
it's sort of been pulverized, and you know you're now drinking. You're drinking your culture through a straw. So that's it. Yeah.
Yes. Let's take this nice fillet steak that's been beautifully cooked. And we'll liquidize it, and then you can just
suck it up.
You can suck it up whilst you also, drink this Coca-Cola whilst scrolling through some videos. I don't know. I mean, so I think, again, counterexample number three, potentially. Let's be honest about most commercial radio and actually even non-commercial radio, and just pop song, pop song, pop song, pop song, travel news, pop song, pop song. Hey, it's National Donut Day. Our mutual friend Brant Hansen takes very, very much against those national days. And hey, it's celebrity news, blah blah blah, and you know, and MTV, you know, in the 80s when it came through, and all that kind of stuff. So, in a way, this is nothing new. But maybe is it the intensity of it as well that I think the human body and the human brain has not really been prepared for? Or maybe it's a spiritual vacuum that has been fulfilled by this stuff as well. So I don't know. Is there anything in that?
Sorry, go ahead, Barry. Mate. No, all I was going to say was the fact that you can't, it's in your pocket. Right, the television was in a room in the house, and the cinema was a place that you had to go and drive to or walk to. That this stuff is just on people, and it is aggressively trying to get hold of your attention to the point where, you know, there's a bit in Lord of the Rings when Bilbo is supposed to be giving the ring to Gandalf, and without thinking he's put the ring into his pocket, like completely subconscious, like didn't even cross his mind, he's just put the ring in his pocket. How many times a day are people without thinking taking their phone out of their pocket to look at it and put it back in their pocket again? This is a thing where we've all just, like, if you took people's phones off them, most adults, right, and teens as well, if you took their phones away, they would seriously have, like, panic attacks. Like, we wouldn't know what to do, because for most of us, it is that compulsive and that addictive that
we feel like we're missing a limb almost.
Yeah.
I think that's right. I was just trying to find a comment by one of our dear patrons, Reese. And he said, I keep trying to find where I first heard it, but I heard someone once refer to smartphones as a, quote, disproportionate technology relative to human beings. A TV, for example, is, I think, a proportionate technology for an adult. They are, in principle, able to regulate their usage of it effectively. It's not proportionate, however, to, say, a three-year-old boy. It's not fair to ask him to learn self-control and to not argue with you when you turn off the big flashing dopamine box in the center of the living room. Smartphones, however, seem disproportionate to basically everybody, certainly as an everyday device. Do you think there's something in that, just that even adults find it hard to regulate their usage of it because of the way it works, because of the interactivity? I know researchers have done research into the fact that, I think it was around about 2012 when the social media like and retweet mechanism was introduced into the software, that became a particular those became particular hooks which really got themselves into human beings, and were specifically designed by Silicon Valley to do so. And obviously the infinite scroll and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, except they were, I think it was unintended consequences, to just give them a tiny bit of credit, because I think what they were trying to avoid was a comment thread of 700 people going, hey, yeah, great. Yeah, totally this. Yes. Oh, so it's this, easy. Love this.
Yeah.
So rather than basically trashing the comments section, making it unreadable, click the like button so you don't have to leave a comment. And suddenly that like button became a popularity contest. Did anyone notice?
I wish I had your faith in human nature that was the case.
I have come across this theory before, and I think that is what it was. Because I don't think that we would think of... I just don't think we're as devious as that. I don't think we're clever enough to say, hey, let's short circuit people's brains with a like button. I think it was more, let's have people able to show their approval without having to essentially use words which would then clutter up the thread so that no one will look at it, because there's 700 messages that all basically say, go, girl.
Maybe. Yeah, whether it's intentional or not, I guess the issue is, it's almost a moot thing, isn't it? It's like, so, all right, so what? This is the effect it has on human beings. Mm-hmm. What do we do with that?
Go on, Nate. You were going to say something.
I was just going to say that. So the like button or the like feature, which is added on Facebook and then sort of gets put onto everything else, has one impact, because it allows people to, as you say, quite neatly show what they like, and therefore the algorithm can sort of present you with more of what you're likely to like, because then you'll be a happier, well, I was about to say customer, but you're not paying. You are the product. The big thing was the retweet button, which was 2009, is the thing that is described by its inventor as handing a fully loaded AK-47 to a toddler. This guy is sort of Robert J. Oppenheimer levels of regret on his invention. So he just says it was awful. Now, in the very short term, 2011, if you think about the Arab Spring, so largely, that's considered a really positive move, because it mobilized loads of people who were able to act in a kind of direct democratic way to have an impact on North African and kind of Arabic countries and the way that they're governed.
Yes.
But the point was, it's so quickly...
And creating democracy so that they get to vote in an Islamist government, which removes any right to vote. So it's like, yeah, I don't think that was a real win in the long term. But
just in terms of the tech optimism is really still going on at that point. So 2008 is really positive, apparently, because Obama is this kind of, you know... kind of ceiling-breaking appointment as the American president, 2008. 2009, as you say, you get the retweet button, and so social media is now being really activated. 2011, Arab Spring, and then 2012 is a kind of tipping point, and a brilliant kind of moment in history is Do you remember Kony 2012? Have you ever heard of that? So it was a it was an intentionally viral video. It was set up as a documentary, and it was designed to get people to overthrow a Ugandan warlord called Joseph Kony. And you can watch the 28-minute video or whatever it was that they produced 2012. And the speed with which that destroyed the life of the guy behind it, because it was too powerful. And it's also 2012 that Jonathan Haidt points to as the moment at which you start getting into this really terminal decline of teenage mental health. So that period, about 2008 to 2012, is absolutely huge in the way that our social media use is reframed. And almost from that point on, we start to think of social media as being a net loss. Oh, it's awful. I wish I could get off it, which has only exacerbated the last sort of 10 years. To the point now where people are sort of looking with awe and wonder at anyone who's able to have a dumb phone. Like, I wish I could be like you.
I like words. I like fat, buttery words, such as ooze, turpitude. I like solemn, angular, creaky words, such as straight-laced, cantankerous, pecunious, valedictory. I like words.
May I have a few with you?
One of the things I'd like to drill down on a little bit is the diagnosis, which I think is common to Ted Joyer, who wrote this article, The State of the Culture, but also you see it in the work of Jonathan Haidt as well. I don't know exactly what the spiritual status of Ted Joyer is, but I think it's probably fair to say that both of those men would describe themselves at least as agnostic, maybe atheists. And so what they have in common is an anthropology where you effectively see human beings as products of evolution, and therefore we are effectively bags of chemicals scudding around in search of other chemicals. And those other chemicals are usually dopamine. That's the thing that keeps coming up again and again in the writings. The reason apparently that we are so addicted to smartphone use and social media use is because, hey, it's easy to explain, because we're just machines looking for particular chemicals. And every time we hit that retweet button, it's kind of releasing, as if to a little lab rat, shots of dopamine. And therefore, that's why we keep coming back. And I feel like as a Christian, much as I think we can learn from, I respect both of these men enormously in the research they've done, there's tons we can learn. And yet the diagnosis or the explanation of what's happening doesn't really go far enough, does it? And therefore, because the diagnosis is not quite right, the prescriptions that they offer to fix it is not quite right. I think it's interesting that, to do Jonathan Haidt credit, he often reaches for what he uses the word spiritual when he's talking about what we've lost and what we need to regain. But I always get the sense that it's almost that it's a slightly pragmatic thing. So we know that for some reason we don't really understand evolutionarily speaking, religion is good for people. It makes them happy. Spiritual things are good. So therefore, we need to kind of hold on to that, whatever that looks like. But it's not because his anthropology believes that there's actually something in religion. It is a delusion, but it's just a helpful delusion. What do you guys think about this diagnosis of, okay, the basic issue here is dopamine, and that's what we've got to look at?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a dopamine denier.
Yes, it exists. It exists.
Yeah, it exists. And I recognize the physical diagnosis, but I would say that it seems to me too easy to, I would say, scientize addiction of this nature. Now, obviously, there are certain things which are chemically addictive in a slightly different way. But I think we easily lapse into the language of anthropology, of, you know, evolutionary psychology as well, is very popular. Obviously, I have no particular interest in perpetuating evolutionary psychology because I don't think it's real. But I think we would do well to use biblical language and categories. And so the fact that the Bible doesn't use the word dopamine shouldn't mean that we don't look to the Bible for a solution to this problem or wisdom, which obviously begins with the fear of the Lord, which is, of course, one thing that people don't particularly want to do. So there's a word called self-control, which is one of the fruit of the Spirit. And I think stuff like that should be reintroduced into this, because I think if we just submit to the scientism, which says I'm powerless against my phone, I have to, and then use other technology to lock up this technology to stop myself from doing this or that. And I limit app usage. So, you know, one of our patrons just said, okay, if you're talking about this, then what are we going to do about it? On the one level, I would say, so what I've done is I during Lent, I removed Instagram completely from my phone and I didn't look at it. Even though quite often I would be near a church or a tree, which is basically my entire Instagram feed, and just think, oh, I wish I could share that picture because that's a beautiful thing. But I'm conscious of the fact that I would then look at Instagram and the time would go by very quickly. My dirty Instagram secret is the fact that I just find people doing impressions incredibly funny. And so I spend an awful lot of time just watching people do impressions. And it's always the same 15 people they do. And I never tire of it. And occasionally you hear someone do Tom Hanks, which is hardly ever done. In fact, there was a guy I watched last night, I've reinstalled it in my phone, who did a Michael J. Fox. And it was incredible. Absolutely incredible. But I've now limited my Instagram usage to 7 minutes. And that 7 minutes absolutely blurs by. I can never believe when it says you've had your 7 minutes that that time has elapsed, and it says, you know, do you want more time? And I say, yes, I do want more time, but I now know that I should probably give it another 5 minutes and then I'm done. But that sign, so that kind of technological solution on my phone to not use Instagram too much doesn't really work, because it doesn't really affect my heart, you know, and I need to, I have a heart problem. I have a self-control problem. And it goes back quite a long time ago when we talked about lust and we talked about, you know, pornography addiction, which is obviously crippling and unbelievably common, to the point where anyone who says they aren't struggling with it is almost certainly lying, unless, you know, they've got some very strong things in place. But again, those technological solutions to that don't work. We need a greater joy, a greater love, a greater desire for the Lord Jesus Christ. Mm. And we have to dwell with him. We have to dwell in his word. And even then, we're going to still struggle to use the self-control. But I just, yeah, this constant talk of dopamine. And Ted, at the very end of his article, mentions a book by Anna Lempke called Dopamine Nation, which, you know, is probably more chapter and verse on this. I just don't think fully committing to let's sort out the dopamine problem. As Christians, I think we can, should, will, must do better than that.
Is it partly the language of addiction too? Just using that word tends to frame human beings, it seems to me, as, you know, machines made of meat or overdeveloped computers who are effectively at the mercy of our programming. And of course, it's now big tech who are apparently programming us. I think if we talk in terms of addiction to particular chemicals, then it does reduce our agency as human beings, doesn't it? And it makes it hard to find a solution then to the whole issue of smartphone and social media, because there's a part of us that's already telling us, oh, you can't do anything about it because you're just, you know, you're just a machine made of meat, and hey, you're at the mercy of your chemicals. And again, that's not a particularly helpful anthropology, is it?
Well, also add to that, if you're a Calvinist, hashtag totes depraved.
Right.
You're totally depraved, and therefore your self-control is abysmal, you know, and we know this. Mm. You couldn't say no to Eve when she offered you the fruit that you knew you should not eat of, when you should have set about that snake with a big stick. So in a way, we can, as Christians, let ourselves off the hook, because we know we are totally depraved. But obviously, you know, on a good day, we are much more serious about fighting sin and mortifying the flesh.
Yes, I was going to say, because Calvinists are not fatalists. So even though, yes, hashtag toast deprav, we still absolutely, we don't believe that that gets us off the hook in terms of our moral responsibility to act. It's, you know, the things that we choose to do are real. It's not an illusion.
Yeah, but we can theologize our dopamine addiction by saying, well, we're totally depraved. That's the dopamine talking.
Yeah, right.
And it's like, no, again, not quite. No, I don't think so.
Yeah. There's a really interesting, maybe we'll link to this as well in the show notes. There's a really interesting, another Substack actually called The Convivial Society, which is L.M. Sarkassus. I think that's how you pronounce his name. And he has put up an article recently giving some of his reservations about this article we've been talking about, which I only came across last night. And again, this is kind of his issue, you know, that the dopamine framing is inadequate and may actually be counterproductive. And he basically asked the question, what is actually happening here? Like, do we keep coming back to our smartphones and to our social media because we are addicted to dopamine specifically? Or, you know, is it because we have no better alternative or we have no good reason not to? And he points back to the idea, he goes back to Blaise Pascal, actually, who, it's a great quote, he said, we naturally seek distraction, you know, not because, well, we have to because dopamine. We naturally seek distraction because we'd rather not have to deal with the thoughts that, I'm paraphrasing here, the thoughts that rise unbidden when we're in moments of solitude and quiet. This is one reason we like our smartphones so much. So we don't want to be thinking particularly about mortality or the vanity of our endeavors or the frailty of the human condition. Do you think there's something in that in terms of the reason underneath our love of our smartphones?
Nate's written in the notes here stuff I'd love to ask him about, which I think relates to this, is we could be tempted to have a spiritual solution to a scientific problem, but actually we have a spiritual solution to a spiritual problem.
Yeah.
And so to what extent is this a spiritual battle between spiritual forces, that what we are up against is slightly more tricky, sinister, and difficult? This isn't just algorithms done by faceless nincompoops at Facebook who didn't know that making a like button would basically create the end of a civilization. Who would have thought that a thumbs up is basically the beginning of the end? I mean, it's so poetic, isn't it? But I mean, Nate, do you have any thoughts on the spiritual battle?
Yeah. So when you asked that question, someone said, it was one of the patrons had asked, what are we going to do? Or something, what are we going to do about this? And I was thinking, absolutely nothing. You are not going to do a single thing to change the situation with regard to a post-entertainment culture and the distraction behemoth, which is coming to devour us all, or the tech algorithmic gods and all that sort of stuff. We are not going to do a single thing about that because we were not consulted in any way, shape, or form about the creation of the issue in the first place. So Steve Jobs in 2007 releasing the, you know, brand new iPhone, iPod, and a internet communicator, right? When he was doing that and casting that sort of vision for a single device world, he was acting in the historically heroic single mode, right? I am the great man of history who has been sent to Earth to lead us all. I'm a modern Prometheus. I've given you fire. I am going to unlock the secrets, and here you go. And we've had successive other tech entrepreneurs who've done that, whether it's, you know, think about Zuckerberg or Elon Musk or what's his name, Jeffrey Bezos. They make their decisions and you change your behavior. That's what happens. So the idea that we're going to do anything about this on a personal scale, or we're going to change anything, is nonsense. We're just going to do what we're told and we're going to use our devices until we have other heroes who stand up for us and who make a change. And I think that's one of the things that's so helpful is in having a historical perspective on this stuff, is that when you look at previous industrial or technological revolutions, you have the advent of, okay, 19th century with the factories and, you know, it's all kind of the mills up north and all that sort of stuff. And the Lord raises up the Earl of Shaftesbury to enact, work tirelessly for his whole career to change the laws to protect the children. That's what made a difference for those helpless little children going up chimneys and whatever else it was. It wasn't that the children just thought, oh, do you know what? I'm gonna, you know, get my way out of this kind of set of constraints. We actively need heroes, and those can be spiritually, you know, obviously we've got, you know, the ultimate hero in Christ and all that sort of stuff. But I don't just want to say, well, Jesus redeems us from our sin, and every other level of human experience is now just us working it out individually for ourselves and having a good accountability group. No, like there are new technologies which need to be brought in to deal with the old ones, and there are new divinely appointed spiritual or socio-spiritual actors, heroes, who will be raised up to try to deal with it. So I'm, yeah, the new Shaftesbury, that's what we need.
So to what extent, though, Nate, do you think that we can be our own heroes and our own champions if we are in Christ? I mean, isn't there a sense in which by the Spirit we ought to at least recognize that something is being done to us that may be permissible but not desirable, and therefore, you know, we ought to...
I think I like the way you're framing it, Nate, in terms of like individually... but culturally and leadership. And I think, but where do leaders come from? They come from smaller groups. You know, big leaders don't just come out of nowhere. They are small leaders. And I was quite struck by, there's a bit of a parallel here, I think, to a previous episode we did on the they, them gender pronoun thing. Steady on, everyone. Go with it. The thing with Jonathan Haidt's book, what's it called again? Barry's reading
the
it. I've read this Kindle sample of it.
Yeah, released last
Anxious week. Generation. Mm-hmm. I heard him interviewed on The Remnant, the Jonah Goldberg podcast. So he sort of explains a lot. And one of the things that was quite clear in terms of the diagnosis and what we can do about it is we have to, as far as kids are concerned, get phones out of schools. We have to get phones out of schools. And because particularly social media on phones is absolute kryptonite for particularly young girls. But what's interesting is particularly young girls who are quite secular and who are left-leaning. It is totally destructive. It's very interesting hearing him talk about that, obviously on a conservative podcast. But for someone who was a sort of a centre-left kind of guy, he sort of moved to the centre, I think. That was quite fascinating and revealing. But I think what was interesting was that there was a sense of powerlessness because individual parents can't persuade their children to not have a phone or not have social media because everybody else doesn't, you know, has it. But actually, if a parent is able to lead and say, we need to change what the school does, and all of the parents agree, and some leadership, it is Christians who are so well suited to do that and can provide that kind of leadership. In the same way that I think one of the things I said when we talked about gender is when you're being asked to put your pronouns on a Zoom screen or whatever, and where's the harm? A lot of non-Christians are very, very unhappy about that, but they don't know why. Whereas this is something where a Christian can just go, yeah, I'm not going to do that. Or why are we doing that? That doesn't seem, can we please just have a conversation about it? And it strikes me as one of those moments in which non-Christians will just go, oh, I'm so glad somebody said something. So I wonder if, you know, where are these leaders going to come from? They're going to come from people who say, this is something we need to do collectively together so that we need a change of policy, either on a local level in a school, on a national level, or in terms of what's acceptable. And so I think that's kind of one tangible way in which Christians are free to make a change, because we don't care what the world thinks about us, or at least we shouldn't. We shouldn't care about whether people click like on us as people.
Yes.
Because the only approval we're looking for is the approval of Christ Jesus.
Yes. And it does feel, doesn't it, there's we might be reaching a kind of critical mass in the culture where, you know, non-believers are recognizing clearly that the damage that this does. A lot of non-Christian parents are like, yeah, this is kryptonite. We do want to deal with this. And it's, again, it's very interesting. There was, is it called South by Southwest? There's a big technology show that happens in Texas. I think it's every year. And all the kind of techie, the people who love technology and the latest developments flock there from all over the world. And at the most recent one, I think it was maybe sort of early in March sometime, some guy was on a sort of a package they put up on the screen, and he was talking about the wonders of AI and how it was the great white hope for the future. And there was actually booing from the crowd, which soon swelled to kind of
critical mass.
Which is, again, you think, well, if these guys at South by Southwest are reacting in that way, that's really something in terms of where the tide is moving societally. And so, yes, I think we're poised, I think, for Christians to say, well, let's get together and actually try and deal with this stuff together, because you can see it, I can see it. I think the sort of the sinister, the thing that apparently really, really prompted the booing was the idea that, in a sense, AI can help us to become more human. That was the thing that really people didn't like. I think people sense that, this is actually reducing what it means to be human rather than augmenting what it means to be human. So then we're back to that question, aren't we, of, all right, our friend on the Discord server, what do we do about this, and how do we diagnose it? And for me, it seems like, obviously, diagnosis is the first step, and it's not sufficient to say, well, it's just because you need dopamine and this is an easy way to get it. You have to kind of look at what's underneath. I think part of it is, what is it that you are escaping from when you glue your eyes to that little slab of metal and glass? It might be the mortality thing, but I think more likely for Christians, and this resonated with me when I read it, because I thought that's exactly why I got so into video games in my 20s and 30s. Not saying video games are bad or whatever. I'm just saying that one other potential reason is that people might be using these devices to turn away from duties that they know they have, responsibilities that they know they have, obligations that they know deep down they ought to be more vigorously pursuing, but that's just quite hard to do that, and it's much easier, and I'd rather not be thinking about those things. So again, maybe if we're asking the question, how do I kind of divorce myself more from my smartphone, it is to think more deeply about things like that. What is it that I'm trying to escape? Now, is it like questions of mortality or whatever, or is it something like particular duties which I don't really want to take up? Is it that, or is it, is it something, what's going on underneath?
For some, it depends on who you are, in terms of, for some it's, I'm doing this because I don't want to face something else. But I wonder if a more common, but maybe not, thing is, I don't have a plan.
Yeah.
I don't know what else I should be doing. And I think, I'm a big fan of Cal Newport, and I've just read his book, Slow Productivity, and which I would recommend. Although, interestingly, he gets sort of 3 and 4 star reviews for it, because a lot of people are saying, I kind of heard all this before. You know, this is just like all of his other books. To which you want to say, I think that's better than him going, my other books are wrong. Don't do it like that. I've just realized that everything I said, do this. No, this time I'm serious. You know, so actually you do want it to say basically the same thing. But he's very wise, and he says, secular guy, I think he's Shabbat, he's a secular Jew, I think, works at Georgetown University, professor of computer science and that kind of stuff. But he says, you can't go cold turkey on your phone if you're going to stop using your phone. What you should do is replace that with a desire to do something else. So get a hobby that you decide, I'm going to do for the next 30 days, I'm not only going to not look at my phone, I'm going to put it in a drawer every time I come in from work. I'm also going to learn how to cook. I'm going to do this sort of book cooking course. So I'm going to learn New Testament Greek. I mean, he didn't say that, but that's kind of what I would do. You know, he say I might learn Hebrew. I'm going to learn an instrument. I'm just going to practice. You need to find other things to do. And I think in a way, it's not just a displacement thing, but you need a bigger and a better goal.
Yes.
So what could you do better with that time? Yes. Rather than just, I need to get off Instagram. I need to get off TikTok. It's like, yeah, but to do what?
Yeah.
And have a greater desire for that other thing, that other person maybe.
Well, I was going to say the person, that's very interesting. You've said that. I think that maybe the question to ask ourselves if we're trying to work out what that thing could be that would displace our addiction, our love of smartphones, is just to ask the question. This is, I think, a good one. What am I looking for when I scroll? What is it that I'm really looking for? And, you know, again, this is in Sarkassus's article, which we'll link to, but, you know, he says, well, one answer to that question is simple and obvious. What am I looking for when I scroll? We're looking for each other. We're looking for human connection.
Hmm.
We're social creatures, and among our most profound immaterial needs is the need for community, and we'll seek to meet that need by whatever means we have available to us. Now, we all know that the kind of community we get via social media is very thin community.
Apart from your Patreon, which is thick community through social media.
Deeply thick, and you
Barry,
get on
remember
there
that.
And waste
Thank
more
you.
Time on that. Yeah, no.
Sorry.
And it's lovely, but again, yeah, what you're looking for? What are you looking for when you scroll? And I suspect the answer to that is, as you said, James, there's a desire to be connected to other people. So what could I do that really gives me a deep version of that connection to other people? That will make me look at the kind of community and connection I get on my smartphone and go, well, that's obviously just a kind of a second-rate version of that.
Yeah. I think, basically, look for ways to go analog. I think there's something in that sense of the default setting is digital, and unless you make plans to do something else, you'll end up scrolling, second screening, or whatever. So therefore, so when I work in the mornings, particularly, I have an app called Freeform Freedom, and it just switches off the internet, and it means I can't. So actually, I listen to music via my phone, which I put, out of reach. So I'm listening to music because I can't get it through my computer. So I don't have the internet. And I quite often just go for 90 minutes. I don't want the internet while I'm just working on this thing. And then I'll need it for email or whatever. But I think in general, we have to take control of these things. So one is sort of the limiting, but then, play a board game. My point is purely analog things.
Yes.
Analog
Buy
things.
A real
yeah.
book,
yeah.
Not a Kindle book. Get a notebook.
Yeah.
Don't use Apple Notes. Read a real Bible.
You have to point out, yes, you're a vinyl skeptic. I saw it quite clearly on the Discord server. You just don't understand the vinyl people. But actually, it helps to explain why people are buying record players. And now apparently vinyl sales are now outstripping CD sales for the first time in years. So it's interesting, isn't it? And I guess a lot of that is precisely because it's going to be engrossing for you and occupy your time. Yeah. Just, okay, I've got to get it out of the sleeve. I've got to whack it on the turntable. I've got to put the stylus down very specifically if I don't want to scratch my record. It's just, it is, there's a connection that happens. It may not be to a person, or maybe it kind of is, but it's happening.
And no one's going to text you on your record player.
Right.
And take you out of the moment.
Sure they won't. Yeah. Well, I guess that's a good place to leave it, isn't it? With that great tip to take up a board game. Buy yourself a record player.
Two more?
Yeah, go on.
Meet up with an actual human being for a drink.
Come on, that's just ridiculous, radical stuff.
And or go to a gig, live music,
what?
Live theatre, live people pretending to be other people and doing a story.
Oh, you're,
how about
you're
that?
You're bombing us back to the 80s here, James. This is, wow, yeah.
The 1580s.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
Imagine.
Yeah. So, I think you're right to draw stumps there. But I think, it is a spiritual
Of course, you know what happens when you go to a gig these days, right?
Yeah.
Everybody's got the smartphones out.
There you go. And that was, and we'll finish with this. It was a comment from the Substack where we started the State of the Culture piece. It says this: a lot of people now no longer think an experience is real or valid in itself unless they can record it on their mobile phone and probably upload it to social media for social validation and attention.
Yeah.
This is crazy. The real world isn't real enough anymore. It has to exist online instead with likes attached. Can almost do that as a haiku or a poem, couldn't we?
I think it. Yeah, it's lovely. Lilting. We said that before we go, it'd be great to find out what you guys are currently reading. Any good titles at all?
Okay, well, so we'll do that on a for the Patreons only.
Oh, yes. Yes,
that's important. We'll say cheerio and then we'll do a quick book chat.
It's a walled garden. But remember that.
The walled garden. So if you would like more of this, then get hooked on the digital world and join us on Patreon. Or you could just send the money and not engage with it. That would also be fine. But we would love you on the Discord because it is actually a community of people chatting, listening, supporting, dipping in and out. Contents may vary, but do join us. So click the link in the show notes to join us on Patreon or Cooper and Carey Plus, and you'll get the extended version of this episode. But before we go, I'm just going to say thank you very much to Nate Morgan-Locke. He's also got a YouTube channel, The Reform Mythologist, so you could go and look at that. But try not to get too sucked in. And Speak Life, of course, where he and Glenn regularly think about the culture and all that kind of stuff. Thanks, Nate. And cheers, Barry.
Cheers, everyone.
And we'll speak to you next time. Cheerio.
Bye.
Ain't no waggling on the tee. It's Barry Cooper and James Carey. 4,000 miles apart, but not alone. Two middle-aged chimps with a microphone. Walking around in their easy fit jeans. 'Cause they won an award in 2018. Moorish as a bag of Funyuns. What do they have against John Funyuns?